Welcome to the Forgettable Reads Podcast, a no-nonsense sleepcast for the rest of us. No creepy whispering, no bad spa music, no sleepy monotone. Just sincere reads of boring, bland material for all your verbal white noise needs. And now your host, Lauren Good.
Good evening, my friends. In the last episode, we talked about the kinds of mental and emotional stories that we create in our inner life of mind. And there's this one quote that I see on my meditation app. It's actually quite funny. It gets stuck on the same quote. It's supposed to change each one afterwards, but I don't know why, but it gets stuck on the same, like, two. Anyway, there's this quote that says, "The mind is what the mind is fed." I've also had two writing mentors suggest that when it comes to writing, it's important to read or consume the kinds of content that you want to create. It's like you're marinating in the right blend of herbs and spices or getting your bearings in a new town. And I agree with that. I think it's immensely helpful. And I've had to think about what kind of content I take in versus the type of content that I want to put out. And the type of content that I watch, read, participate with has changed quite drastically over my adult life. So when I was younger, I used to love reading Stephen King or sometimes young adult thrillers or some Dean Koontz or Michael Crichton or something else that was like a little bit gritty but still fairly mainstream, mass market, etc. Later in college, I fell in love with Jane Austen and with fantasy series. And then after college, once I had started acting, my day job was at Barnes & Noble, which meant I had as much employee discounted access to books, movies, music as one could ever hope for. And my collection got real big, real fast. But I will tell you, moving your library from place to place, in my case, from Dallas to Chicago, will immediately put a stop to that habit. But then, after reading all of this fiction and really enjoying that genre, then came the nonfiction era. I started to fall in love with thought leaders like Brené Brown and Seth Godin, and I hardly ever allowed myself to read fiction, unless it was vacation, until the start of the pandemic. Then, when the pandemic started, I started searching for mystery series, and that's how I would end my day. Then, about, I would say, three quarters the way through lockdown, something happened, and to this day, I'm not really sure what it is or why. I just can no longer settle myself when I read fiction. I as far as I can tell, it's like I feel guilty that I'm not doing something more productive with my time. Now, I'm getting hints that this situation is coming back online, but between that and losing the stamina to do my favorite jigsaw puzzles, I just kind of accepted that this was, you know, my new normal, and I really hoped it would be temporary. The amount of joy that I used to get from puzzles and reading fiction was great. So I think, I mean, when I look back on conversations that I had over that time, I think everyone saw some sort of shift in what they were feeding their minds, right? The mind is what it's fed. I think we all kind of shifted what we were eating, so to speak. And whether that was binging every show on Netflix and HBO and Prime and Hulu and whatever else, or for some people, they lost the attention span to watch anything at all. So I feel like we kind of all collectively went through some kind of entertainment metamorphosis. Now, these same writing mentors who gave the advice about trying to steep yourself in the type of content that you want to write also gave some pretty stellar advice about the actual writing process. So, for example, writing in 2-inch frames or treating the writing like it's a Polaroid that would eventually develop more detail out of what initially appears to be just a murky, small square. And I think the reason why that advice exists and helps so much is because when you set out to do something, if you think about how big it is, if you think about how many steps are involved, the mind starts to kind of push back on you. And so it's like, no, just, you know, kind of roughen this little 2-inch frame. And then as the detail comes out and as you start adding more 2-inch frames, you know, it'll develop more organically. Then there was another teacher who suggested that writing from a place of revenge is completely acceptable as long as you change enough detail to not commit libel. She was like, if you're expressing your truth, then you keep writing. And speaking of that, that was the final piece, was truth wants to be expressed. And so when we create or when we write, we're trying to give a voice to the unspeakable. Language is for us as humans like water is for fish, and yet sometimes language fails to touch the scope or the poignancy of an experience. So the process is to let it wash over you, see if you can find some threads to follow. The very last piece of advice that I got from Natalie Goldberg, she said, stay in the space where you don't know the answer longer than you think you need to. And then, I mean, I swear to God, she looked right at me through the Zoom camera and said, you don't always need to Google. Now, of course, she wasn't speaking to me personally, but I definitely guilty as charged. So I guess when an experience is beyond words and you're trying to give it a voice, or in some way, what you're trying to do is share it with others so they can enjoy it. It can touch them. It can teach them something. It can be a catharsis. It can be, you know, that beautiful shared feedback loop that performance provides. How do you bring the 3D into the 2D? Now, this is a question I love to ponder. So now I'm sharing it with you. But tonight's reading is very 2D. It was a technical article on statistical measures that I was asked to produce audio for. And my dears, please let it bore you right the frack to sleep. Or not. If it doesn't, then maybe you'll relearn something you once knew from high school or college but had long forgotten. And maybe, just maybe, it will win you a trivia round someday. Taking stock of p-values as a decision-making tool, an emerging best practices view of significance versus meaningfulness by Susan Schwartz McDonald and Michael Polster of the Naxion leadership team. There is seldom a shortage of data these days. What's often missing is conviction about which data trends to care about. A key focus of market research is the interpretation of statistical differences and whether they actually matter. When marketing teams want to know how pleased or worried to be about a change, or whether the difference between two numbers confers leverage, they routinely ask researchers, is it significant? By which they mean, is this difference real or merely the product of chance? Although the question can be answered based on the simple calculation of a p-value, the relevance of the answer is less straightforward. P-values have long been a North Star for guiding decisions based on data, but they can also lead us astray. It's important to understand what p-values offer, what their limitations may be, and what else we can do when p alone cannot provide adequate decision support. Significance testing based on p-values has infiltrated even our popular culture, so much so that terms like statistically significant and within the margin of error are now well known to any American voter who keeps an eye on the polls. Ironically, just as the broader population were becoming more familiar with the concept of statistical significance, researchers and statisticians were growing more strident in challenging its use. Uneasiness about the way p-values can be misinterpreted and abused has led prominent organizations like the American Statistical Association and the American Psychological Association to largely abandon the use of null hypothesis significance testing, or NHST, in favor of a different estimation framework that shifts the emphasis toward the magnitude of difference between numbers and away from the probability of observing that difference merely by chance. One respected academic journal has gone so far as to say it will not publish p-values at all. So, after years of colorful p-thrashing by statisticians themselves, there is finally consensus in the sciences that we need a shift in focus from significance to meaningfulness. But despite its focus on methodological innovation, the insights industry has been largely insulated from the debate about P for several good reasons. Habits die hard everywhere, and the market research community is no exception. In our neighborhood, the P habit has been given added reinforcement by the need for consistency of approach in the interpretation of tracking metrics. And since most market research studies are largely proprietary, research conclusions and methods are not necessarily subject to peer review or academic debate. As a result, many highly experienced market researchers have had little or no exposure to the charges leveled against null hypothesis testing and its call letter P. That has meant less opportunity to become familiar with alternative statistical approaches. So, why do we need alternatives to P? There are some practical limitations to NHST that spring from its intellectual origins and its method of calculation. NHST is meant to tell us whether the observed difference between two estimates should be treated as probably real or the product of chance based on sampling error. If the observed difference fails to reach our designated threshold of significance, the difference is deemed probably not real. If the difference does reach our designated threshold of significance, we can assume it's probably real. In data, as in life generally, it is helpful to distinguish the highly probable from the improbable, but probably real and meaningful are two very different notions. Which is to say, statistically significant does not equate to consequential. Significance does not tell us how much to care or whether to take action. Conversely, differences that fail to meet the test of significance can still be real and potentially quite consequential. The inability to address meaningfulness, a fundamental limitation of NHST, is closely related to its other deficiencies. First of all, statistical significance is heavily influenced by sample size, which can mislead us about what is consequential in the data. If the sample size is large enough, almost any observed difference will qualify as significant. On the other hand, if the sample size is small, for instance, when the customer universe or the available pool of willing respondents is limited, statistically significant findings are hard to come by, even though there may be real and important differences lurking in the data set. The rationale for weighting sample size so heavily in significance calculation is rooted in the premise that sample size can correct for sampling error. But sample size doesn't always do that, nor can it be relied on to solve all the other problems we may encounter on the path to statistical certainty. The temptation to trust statistics based on large sample sizes alone needs to be resisted. Secondly, despite the presumption that significant results have not occurred merely by chance, they frequently fail to replicate, which is a key reason for the recent wholesale defection from P in the scientific community. This crisis of replication has plagued scientific inquiry for decades, undermining confidence in the conclusions drawn even from studies that produce highly significant results. The reasons for this apparent anomaly have to do with the nature of the NHST concept and calculation, as well as the manner in which researchers tend to frame and test hypotheses in pursuit of the holy grail of significance. This crisis of replication demonstrates how easy it is to be lured into a sense of false confidence about data when we look only to P to establish its credibility. Yet another problem is statistical significance is a binary idea in a world shaded by gray, even though people may be tempted to blur the line when calls are close. In NHST, a p-value is either statistically significant or it's not. You can, of course, grade on a curve by lowering the bar, for example, from 0.05 to 0.10, but because both sample size and magnitude of difference influence the outcome, decisions made on the target threshold can seem and be arbitrary. To state that a number tends towards significance is a statistical wink that violates the basic premise of the test, though it's in line with the cloudier nature of reality, which routinely plays out on a continuum. Finally, significance testing does not allow for comparisons across effects or studies, limiting its usefulness in setting priorities. A difference that yields a p-value of 0.0001 is not more important or more meaningful than a difference whose p-value is 0.05, even when they appear in the same study. Nor can a statistically significant change in Net Promoter Score, or NPS, be compared to a statistically significant difference on a 6 or 7 point rating scale in the same survey. Each statistical test must be considered on its own terms. Unfortunately, researchers don't necessarily appreciate or live by that rule. They are often tempted to draw inferences and set priorities based on comparisons of p-values. Though p is an indisputably important tool, there are other tools available, like effect size, to help us decide what's meaningful in our data. Standardized effect size calculations allow the observer to consider the magnitude and potential meaningfulness of the difference between two values, unconflated by sample size, so long as you have confidence in the estimate the sample has provided. In other words, you trust your instrument and your respondents to deliver valid information. The most commonly used effect size statistics is Cohen's D, a calculation introduced over 3 decades ago by Jacob Cohen, a renowned quantitative psychologist, whose statistical writing is so lively that even a non-statistician may be charmed. For those with an interest in formulas, Cohen's D divides the mean difference between two variables by the pooled standard deviation of those two variables. Because it is a standardized measure and thus not directly driven by sample size, Cohen's D makes it possible to 1. Compare means from small sample sizes that are unlikely to yield statistically significant differences. 2. Compare effect sizes within and across studies and even across dependent variables in a way that significance outcomes cannot. And 3. Assess how meaningful any observed difference might potentially be based on its actual size. Cohen suggested several thresholds for small, medium, and large effects based on data from his experiments with psychology students. Others have proposed that effect sizes in the social sciences must exceed 0.4 to be of practical significance. Naxion is currently using Cohen's suggested thresholds to flag the level of importance or meaningfulness, but we are working to assess whether any adjustments might be needed for market research databases. In some datasets, Cohen's D has helped us spot meaningful trends that might have gone overlooked due to sample size, or has given us grounds to deprioritize significant effects unlikely to yield a meaningful return. By backstopping significance testing with Cohen's D, we've been able to reinterpret what looked like a significant preference for one product over another as, instead, a dead heat, and in another case, confirm that a non-significant trend in market tracking was actually meaningful enough in D terms to warrant concern. We will work through some actual data examples in an upcoming webinar. So, here's our advice. Wear a belt with your suspenders. Of course, no statistic delivers canned, ready-to-consume meaning right off the shelf. There's always art to the behavioral science. Using data for effective decision support requires an interpretive framework customized to the priorities and challenges of each enterprise. The case we are making is not to abandon p-values. It's to look at D for a more complete and more nuanced picture, especially in verticals like healthcare, B2B, technology, and even in broad consumer categories when small subsegments of particular interests are hard to find or afford. In a nutshell, effect sizes are a helpful backstop when your differences don't meet a target significance threshold, and they can help avoid overreaction to blips driven by large sample sizes. It's time for decision science to join the other sciences by adding a few letters to our statistical alphabet.